Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Have you ever wondered what it's like to be stung by a murder hornet or bitten by a piranha? Whether you did or not, thanks to YouTuber Coyote Peterson and his channel Brave Wilderness, we know not to stick our hands in a nest of yellow jackets. He's been posting videos on YouTube since 2014 and is an Emmy winner and nominee for his many TV series. Welcome to All Sides, Coyote.
Hey, thanks for having me, Amy. Excited to be here.
Now, when you are not being chased by alligators or a swarm of wasps, how do you introduce yourself? Do you call yourself a YouTuber or do you call yourself a wildlife educator?
I wear a number of different hats, I would say. Definitely, first and foremost, wildlife educator and conservationist. At the end of the day, everything that we do, no matter how extreme it might seem, is always going to have an educational message to it to help people sort of recognize the importance of the wildlife that exists. And of course, if there's an applicable conservation message, that is usually the driving force. But I know what the most popular stuff is.
Now, it seems like your audience is mainly a little bit younger. For some people, you're a childhood staple for them. Do you see your videos as being educational but also entertainment? Which one outweighs the other?
For sure. We use a term and have for almost a decade now called edutainment. With my background specifically is in screenwriting, producing, and directing. So I know the world behind the camera first and foremost. So stepping in front of the camera to create content, we knew that we had to have a certain level of entertainment to keep an audience grasped. Certainly now in the digital space, I mean, even when we started on YouTube 10 years ago, making something that was considered short form, which back then was like 10 minutes, now it's like 15 seconds. We knew that if you didn't have an entertaining twist, you wouldn't get people to hang around to absorb that education. And if you tell people you're going to educate them, and a lot of times they're like, I don't really know if I want to go through this. But if they're highly entertained and then they walk away and they're like, wait a minute, you tricked me into eating the vegetables? I got my education. They feel pretty good about it, and so do we.
Yeah. So did this interest come to you later in life, or did you always love being brave in the wilderness?
I mean, I guess I could say that, you know, my mom would say I was probably always brave in the wilderness. I look at my mom and I'm like, Mom, why? Who lets their kid at like 6 and 7 years old just wander off into the woods for hours at a time without having to check in? That makes me nervous. I feel like there should be a Netflix documentary about me as a child. But I'd say to answer the question of brave, yeah, I'm brave in a certain way. But I'm also very calculated for as crazy as some of the stuff is that I appear to do. We do a lot of research ahead of time, but I know some of the animals that I get up close with or environments that I enter into, people would look at that and say, you're absolutely nuts. Well, I could look at a lot of professions out there and be like, you're absolutely nuts, and things that are not nearly as dangerous as the stuff that I do. Again, it all comes down to an individual's perception. But, you know, we try to do our best to make sure that we are encouraging people to get outside and still explore the wild while giving them that well-rounded education into there are things out there that can potentially be dangerous. Here's how to avoid those situations. Or if you find yourself in the worst case, what do you do to ensure that you and that animal can both walk away in opposite directions and say, whoa, that was just a close call.
And you grew up in Ohio. Mm-hmm. So how did the natural environment here influence your career?
Oh, hugely. I wouldn't be who I am today if it wasn't for one specific animal called the common snapping turtle. So for those listening that know snapping turtles, maybe you see them crossing the road, a female on its way to lay eggs or something in an old farm pond where you're like, oh my gosh, that turtle could bite a broomstick in half, which actually isn't the case. But they are incredibly gregarious and oftentimes per their name, snapping turtle, very snappy and aggressive reptiles if tangled with. And when I was a little kid, I spent a lot of time honing my animal catching skills with snapping turtles. So it was that species specifically that got me fascinated and then sort of really dialed me in with the ability to be just a little bit quicker than the things that I'm going to interact with. And that doesn't happen every time. I do have my slip-ups, but snapping turtles were a great species to test out the skills with.
Did you, I mean, nowadays you wouldn't keep one as a pet, but did you have, did you name your snapping turtles that you would find and that kind of thing?
Oh, no, I have a pet snapping turtle.
Of course you do.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. She's I've been raising her since she was out of the egg. Her name is Nubbly. Actually, next week I have one of the best pond building teams in the United States, Aquascapes, and my good friend Greg is going to be in town building a pond in my backyard for the snapping turtle.
What a fancy snapping turtle. That's a fancy lady.
For being a tiny little turtle still, she's only 8 years old, but she's gonna be living like a queen, that's for sure.
Living large. So you're an Ohio State alum. Mm-hmm. You studied film production and writing. So how did it transfer, you know, being an Ohio State alum that studied film production? How did you end up with a wilderness show? I understand like the video part of it, but, you know, you could have filmed anything, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, a couple of things coming together all at the right time. I mean, and that becomes everything with entertainment, as you know, and having the skill sets to understand how a production chessboard is put together, how to package something, how to get it in front of the right people and say, look, this is a good idea. Here's why we are qualified to go out and take financial resources to make that vision come to fruition. And we struggled for many years when it came to the animal side of things. And I've got a whole crazy long story of going down the road of trying to produce independent films. And, you know, sadly, in 2006, Steve Irwin passed away. And there became this huge gap in the entertainment education space for animals. And you started having shows that were bleeding in that were more ensemble characters or things like Man versus Wild with Bear Grylls, which I love Bear. Bear and I are business partners, phenomenal individual. But when Man versus Wild came out, he was catching and eating animals to show you, well, in a worst case scenario, you could eat this to survive. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it's cool. And you're catching these things and you're eating these things. But how do we take your style of production with like good music, fast editing, very intense storylines, and couple that back together with the idea of catching animals, but work in the Steve Irwin of it all. Mm-hmm. Promote the conservation, educate people about these animals, tell people why they don't need to be afraid of these things, why they need to appreciate the purpose that they serve on our planet. And, you know, again, place and time, we tried to develop a TV show for a number of years. Everybody said no. We actually almost worked in collaboration with Jack Hanna and the Columbus Zoo at one point. Again, a deal that kind of fell apart in negotiation stages. And then we found YouTube. And at the time, I had no interest in anything YouTube because to me, as somebody who has a filmmaking degree, I'm like, all right, YouTube is cat videos, prank videos, like low quality production. But it also gave you the opportunity to distribute without anybody telling you what you should or shouldn't be putting on screen. And by that, I mean, you know, no executives being like, yeah, maybe you could edit it like this or do that. Mm-hmm. And we put it out and all of a sudden we started noticing that this is where the views were coming from. And this was September of 2014 that we launched the Brave Wilderness Channel. And it's just been nonstop since then.
We're talking with Coyote Peterson, creator of the Brave Wilderness YouTube channel. He's also a wildlife educator and he hosts several TV series. Now, I have watched many of your YouTube videos. They all look very painful. what is the most painful or dangerous encounter you've had? And for our listeners who may not know, basically, you go out there and you let things sting you or bite you or you touch things that you shouldn't touch to show people what happens.
I love the you touch things that you shouldn't touch. You're right. I mean, right now I'm actually, we just did a poison ivy episode where probably the only people to ever collect poison ivy and actually make a slushy out of it and then paint it onto our skin. I did this with a young gentleman named Ray Tiller, who's coming up on the Brave Wilderness channel right now. And poor Ray's got it really bad today because he's much more susceptible to poison ivy than I am. I've barely had any reaction. It's actually the first time in my entire life I've shown signs of getting poison ivy from poison ivy. So, you know, plants, obviously something you don't want to touch. But with a lot of the intentional bites and stings that I've taken, and in all fairness for the audience listening, it is a rather small percentage of the grand ensemble of content we've created. but it's without question the most popular. And you can imagine why, with the audience being like, is this guy really going to put his hand into a box with 200 yellow jackets, which is something that I've done. I will admit is the dumbest experiment I've ever attempted. And I was stung about 100 times in 10 seconds. And after that, 36 hours of endless pain that you can't even fathom how much it hurts to take that much venom and have to like just fight through it for that many hours. So, yeah, I've been through the ringer a couple times.
Now, I was trying to figure out what your most popular video was. There's so many, it was hard for me to figure out. But, you know, the bloodworm video has 80 million views. There's an alligator bite video with 44 million views. Do you have a favorite?
I always say that my favorite episode is one that I'm usually currently working on because it's so fresh. Just 2 weeks ago, we were working with an amazing conservation group in the Okefenokee Swamp of Georgia. And we got the chance to go out with a team whose mission was to try to catch the largest American alligator living in this swamp. And they'd only seen it a handful of times over like the course of the past half decade. And we got a sponsor to come in and essentially finance this very high-tech transmitter that if we could find this alligator, they wanted to actually place it on it, the back of its neck so that they could follow its movements. And I kid you not, the first night we were out, they were like, dude, I think that's the alligator. And we saw, I mean, this is a huge swamp. I mean, hundreds of thousands of acres. And sure enough, we caught it. It was a 300-pound, 10.5-foot alligator. It was an absolute dinosaur. And just getting to work with a team like that and be a part of their process and to show the magnificence of these animals, but then to also have an important piece of science and conservation that then became attached to this animal that will become research for the next 3 years of where this animal goes, why they see it so seldomly, and where it ultimately hunkers down throughout that swamp will be great information for them. So to answer your question, that's my favorite episode I've worked on as of recent because of all the pieces, parts that came together to not only make it happen, but for us to have caught that exact animal that we were after and now to be able to put all those story pieces together and be able to promote that research for them.
Do you try to teach your viewers to have a healthy amount of fear of certain things so that they don't go out and try to do what you're doing? Like, you always put cautions in your videos where, like, don't try this at home, basically.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that we ever tried to give people a level of fear as a term that I would define. It's more so a level of respect and understanding. Mm-hmm. Being cognizant of your environment is important. Animals were there first. We're the ones that are wandering into it. So in any situation where you've got a negative interaction between a human and an animal, it's usually the animal that's to blame. And that's because, well, we as humans are forming that from our opinionated side of things. And if you've got a general respect for the things that are out there and you are being careful, these animals generally want to avoid you. So being in tune with your environment is usually the thing we try to instill with our audience. To ever be like, you should be afraid of something, I kind of feel is, you know, if you've made a mistake before and you're not learning the first time around, it's like, all right, if you're going to go get stung by something multiple times, and I'm not saying an audience member, I'm saying me who's learned from it, you know, you think you would have a certain level of fear at that point. But no, for the most part, we're encouraging people to recognize and have respect for these things first and foremost.
Well, I was going to ask you if you ever felt truly scared doing one of the videos, but maybe your respect was just heightened rather than being scared per se.
Yeah, scary situations happen when you least expect them. Like there was a situation that happened to us in Alaska a few years ago where we were filming on the side of a river and we came upon a mother grizzly and her three like German shepherd sized cubs. So these are cubs that are learning to hunt. And we were in a situation where it was like, man, this is going to go one of two ways. Either she's going to attack and this is going to end really badly for us, or she's going to take the cubs and go in the opposite direction, or she's going to charge and we're going to have to use bear spray. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, she made that decision of like, nope, couple of humans, I'm going the opposite direction, which is usually the case. But, you know, that definitely gets your heart rate going to be as close as we were to four bears.
And you always mention that you have an EpiPen with you. So, I mean, I guess that helps whenever you don't know how you're going to react in these situations, right?
Yeah. Well, in a bear situation, the EpiPen's
EpiPen is not helping. Yeah.
Maybe to take away some of what a bear mauling might be. But no, with the EpiPen, you know, a lot of people always think that, you know, with insect venoms, like what sort of danger am I actually ever in? And the answer is not much. Most people are not in danger of most insect and arachnid venoms. Now, if we're talking about venomous snakes, that's a whole nother category of dangerous venom. Mm. But it's usually the human body having an allergic reaction to venom that can become the thing that's most dangerous, which is why having an epinephrine pen on location at all times, whether you're somebody who's just out adventuring, carrying that in your backpack is always a smart way to go, because you get stung by a bee tomorrow and not know how you're going to react to it.
Mm. And it seems like in most of the videos, you always use one particular arm, your forearm. Do you stick with the one arm? Did you ever think about a different body part?
I've beaten up several parts of my body at this point, and both arms and hands, but it's usually my left arm that gets the brunt of the impact because I'm right-handed. And when it comes to specifically being able to hold a small, little, delicate insect or arachnid, again, we want to be as careful with these things as we can so we don't ever actually injure the things that are going to sting me. It gives me a better level of control so that I can make sure that the shot is in focus for the cameras and that the sting is actually happening.
So Ohio's your home base, right? Mm-hmm. This is Ohio is home. And I'm guessing you can't do a lot of your videos here. Maybe the poison ivy video, you could do that here, right? There's plenty of poison ivy.
You'd be surprised how many videos we have actually filmed here in Ohio and right in our backyards right here at the Columbus Metro Parks. I've been working with them for a number of years. 1 week ago today, I was literally at Blendon Woods and Blacklick Woods. And on a yearly basis, I do a snapping turtle survey. And we usually film these surveys and went out and caught a bunch of snapping turtles to check up on their health conditions and stuff like that. So Ohio is incredibly biodiverse when it comes to animals. And when it comes to filming opportunities, we've certainly taken our fair share of adventures around here to capture on camera.
Is there anything in Ohio that people should definitely try to avoid?
The great thing that I love about Ohio is honestly how safe it is, especially for a younger generation. You know, there are some venomous snake species way down south. Occasionally, black widows and brown recluse have been sighted, but a lot of times they're few and far between. I mean, if you're here in Columbus, Ohio, and you want to think about, man, can my kids go out in the backyard and play safely and pretty much pick up any animal other than maybe a snapping turtle? The answer to that is yes. There is nothing here in Ohio that is going to send you to the hospital. Now, getting stung by a wasp or a bee, sure, that's going to hurt a little bit. And if you don't have an allergic reaction, it's just going to make you a bit tougher.
So like your mom let you wander around in the woods at a young age, would you recommend to listeners out there, go wander in the woods, have fun?
I've watched so many scary documentaries at this point on streaming services that I look at the stuff I did as a kid. I was like, man, like I feel like I was just asking for trouble. But no, I think that parents should feel pretty comfortable letting their kids go out and adventure nowadays. And in fact, putting down their social media devices or stepping away from the TV or from the video games and getting outside and letting the metro parks, letting our local city parks, letting anywhere like that be the playground and get kids outside exploring is what we're always trying to encourage.
And then when they come back to their phone for just a minute or two, their iPad, you know, look up one of your videos, right?
Yeah.
Because then you'll learn something.
I'm the good homework on the way home, riding home from the park. Maybe you saw some cool snake species. You look it up on Brave Wilderness, like, oh yeah, coyotes already interacted with this thing or gotten bitten by it.
So what's next? Continue with the YouTube series? Any more TV work?
Yeah, so I just finished directing a feature film called That Bear Kid. It's a documentary. We actually just had the premiere this past Friday at the Wexner Center. So that's being shopped in Hollywood right now to the streaming networks. We're getting ready for a very large trip to Komodo Island this summer. We're doing a big Komodo dragon episode partnered together with a biological researches center. And aside from that, we've got a new TV series in development that goes into production in January, set in the Bahamas. So it's a busy time, that's for sure.
Yeah, you're not busy at all, right? Well, I want to thank you for your time. That's Coyote Peterson, creator of the Brave Wilderness YouTube channel, a wildlife educator, and a television host. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Amy. This was wonderful.
And this is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And I'm Amy Jurevich.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Whether a patient admitted for a chronic illness or a nurse tending to others' needs, in a hospital, the beeping of an EKG machine and the buzzing of those fluorescent lights is often not very melodious. But patients with cancer who spend several weeks in the hospital, the mundane environment doesn't necessarily benefit their treatment. All the way back in 2001, Columbus's Ohio Health decided music could be a solution. Joining us today is acoustic guitarist John Morgan. He was the artist in residence for Ohio Health from 2001 to 2022, where he played music for cancer patients, and he turned his experience into a book. Welcome to All Sides, John.
Thanks, Amy. I'm glad to be here.
So as an artist in residence, is that a role that a lot of hospitals have, or was it something unique to Ohio Health to have a guitarist as an artist in residence?
My understanding at the time was that it was in a unique position. I hope a lot of hospitals will grow in that because it's so beneficial to patients.
Now, in your book, you mentioned that the program started with 8 artists, and then soon you realized that eventually you were the only one left. Why did you stay?
Well, it was just a fascinating opportunity. At that time, I had some time in the morning. I'd go and volunteer for an hour, and I could just go and play music, and it helped people. So what's not to like about that? It was really a very interesting, especially in a medical environment, to see how music touched people.
Now, were you going every day, or was it just once a week? How did you work it out a schedule?
Well, the reason there were 8 musicians, it was once every 2 months for 1 hour.
Mm.
So that was just a little dip in the toes in the water. And after 2 years, one time, you know, I always try to stay in touch with the cleaning people since they know what's going on.
That's smart.
And this lady said, "We're so glad to see you." I said, "Well, you have music every week." She said, "Nope, you're the only one still here."
Oh, wow. Okay.
That was after 2 years.
And you ended up staying for more than 20 years, right?
Well, that position was actually a volunteer position.
Mm.
And then the art therapist from Riverside caught up with me one day and said, "Hey, when I get a budget, I'm going to hire you for Riverside."
Hmm.
And about a year later, sure enough, she got a budget, gave me a call, and then that's when I started playing. I was there multiple days a week at that point.
Okay. So this artist in residence, is that Jennifer? Is that right?
Yeah. Jennifer Quinn.
So you worked very closely with her. You mentioned her a bunch in the book. So was she basically like your boss? She hired you?
Well, we were actually peers, but she was the one who had the most experience working with patients. So she got me off to a good start by throwing me in the deep end of the pool.
Okay. So you worked mainly at Riverside for a bunch of those years.
Yes, most of the time.
Okay. So how many hours a week? You said in the morning?
Well, it would be at one point, eventually I worked up to 20 hours a week.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So yeah, it would be and some outlying locations also. It was just an opportunity to meet people, some in infusion, some inpatient. All different, and some in radiation treatment also.
You must have become a fixture with your guitar wandering around. I can just imagine everyone saying, "Oh, there he goes again."
Well, it was kind of funny that at first when I started, you know, I get a little looks from doctors occasionally like, "Oh my gosh, what's next? We're going to have people burning incense in the hallway." But then a lot of those doctors became friends, and I ended up teaching one doctor's son guitar and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So the medical, you know, you're in a, with the arts, you're bringing something different to the healing situation. And the doctors are completely into the science and all that aspect. So what was interesting is to bring this art in and see how the two can blend so well.
Now, you turned your experience, all those years of playing music for people who were in the hospital, you turned them into a book. Mm-hmm. And you call the book Notes in the Key of C, Tuning Out Cancer, Tuning in Hope.
Yes.
How did you settle on that title, Notes in the Key of C?
Well, I have a friend who's written several books. He hiked the Appalachian Trail and a number of amazing things. And we were sitting around one evening and he said, "You know, what are you thinking of calling this?" And we just kind of brainstormed a bit. And he kind of came up with that, with the notes in the key of C, because the play on words there. And then actually my granddaughter, Abigail, came up with the subtitle because we didn't want people to think it's a music instruction book, you know.
I see. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's definitely not a music instruction book. It tells stories of your interactions with patients over the years and what they asked you to play, basically, and how it helped them in your interactions with their families as well.
Yeah.
But you introduce each story with a different song title. I thought that was a really nice touch.
But it seemed appropriate. You know, because a lot of these stories kind of begged the song, so to speak. And yeah, I just thought that would be a good connecting point.
Now, you mentioned the songs listed in the book are everything. You know, you have James Taylor, you have Ben King, you have Sting. I mean, there's so many different genres of music mentioned in here. Elvis Presley. Mm-hmm. Do you know every song when someone requests it?
Well, that was a vicious rumor that got around. The nurses would occasionally say, just ask him for anything.
He can play anything. Oh.
Well, and part of it's an accumulation. I've built a database of songs because I've taught guitar for a number of years. And so that database I had for students has actually, that was my source. I had to learn all these songs to teach people. And then I'm also, I'm the chief cat herder of a jam session. Mm. And so I built songs for that. So I've enjoyed digging into many different styles and genres. It's really a blast.
So if someone requested a song and you didn't know it, would you say, I'll be back next week if you're still here and I know it?
You got it.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd figure the song out by ear. And with the help from the lyrics on the internet, and let's go from there. Yeah, because music in any form is beneficial to us health-wise, if you're healthy or sick. And but if you'd really tune into what a person loves, that's going to be the most beneficial.
Now, and did you see some patients who you saw a lot, like they were there for a long time?
There was an interesting thing I noticed. The first 10 years, I didn't see repeat patients a lot. But, you know, there's all this money and research and all these things. And in the last 10 years that I was there, it was amazing that I would see people on an ongoing basis and really have a chance to get to know them. That just speaks to all the wonderful people that are doing the research and helping.
So you're saying that people would more likely, the first 10 years, they were more likely to not make it, but then they... maybe they would make it and then live on.
You know, yeah. It went from where, you know, and it's not my business what happens to people in every detail, but it would be to the point where I would get to know people and I'd know it was because of the treatment. You know, I mean, the nurses would tell me, you know, oh, we're doing this now and this. Now. Yeah. So it was just amazing to see the positive benefits of all that research.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Fascinating Ohio. And we are here with local acoustic guitarist John Morgan, who also wrote a book about his time playing music for patients for Ohio Health, mostly at Riverside Hospital. Now, your book is beautiful and it has emotional stories. I mean, it's really lovely, all the stories you tell about the patients and how the songs play into your relationships with them and their family. Is there one in particular that stands out the most for you? Do you have a favorite story in the book?
Well, I have a lot of favorite stories, but the one I like to start off with because it's so wonderful is a morning when I was sitting there and I was playing one of my original pieces. It was kind of complex. And a couple walks in. Only the receptionist and I were the only people aside from them. And we had this little interchange, and the guy was just really funny. He was quite comedic. And so we had a nice little exchange. And then they sat down and kind of settled in. So I'm kind of looking, okay, judging by the age, era. So I said, fly me to the moon and let me. So I thought that would be a little Frank Sinatra. Mm-hmm. But then out of the corner of my eye, I see this movement. I'm sitting down. I see this movement and I look up and these people are ballroom dancing across the lobby. Mm-hmm. I'm there. The receptionist is there, the admin, and they're dancing like, oh my gosh. And not... when my wife and I dance, it's lean this way, lean that way. But when these guys were dancing, it was like he's dipping her, he's spinning her, he's doing all this. And then immediately when the song ended, they took one more step and the nurse walked in and said, the doctor's ready to see you. Mm-hmm. So what I'm thinking is, oh my gosh. I found out later, they were going to a 6-month follow-up checkup.
Oh.
So I thought, here are two people. Obviously, he's been in this treatment for, you know, maybe 6 to 8 weeks. They don't know the results. They don't know what they're going to hear, but they hear music and they begin to dance. And to me, that just spoke, here's how we get through life. We don't know what we're going to hear in the next 5 minutes, but we got music. We know how to dance. This is the way we move through life.
That's beautiful.
It was a wonderful experience. You might as well dance
when you have the moment. Yeah, that's amazing. Now, and you also got to know families during this time, too. So you're playing for the patients, but did you find your music also helped the non-sick people in the room?
Yes. On occasion, reasonably often, the patient might be unresponsive. Maybe they're, you know, on some kind of relaxer or whatever. And the family would be there. And that's when I could get to know the person, too. They would ask for stories. Oh, he likes Johnny Cash. She likes James Taylor. And so when the person would be responsive, we could jump in and do that.
Did you play music for kids too? Did you know some kids' songs?
Well, it was funny because one time, I mean, yeah, kids show up in hospitals, mm-hmm. and it was wonderful to be able to do a little Itsy Bitsy Spider or Wheels on the Bus, mm-hmm. because these kids, just think how you'd be. You're a little kid. You're in this big hospital. Somebody in your family is having a rough time. You're going to be kind of freaked out, mm-hmm. but then you play A B C D E F G, and the kids start to relax. And what that also makes the patient very relaxed. And if my family's being taken care of, that's a beautiful thing.
Now, tell me a little bit about your music career, because you say in the book that you are unhindered by fame or fortune, but steadily pursuing a musical dream. Do you still feel like that, or is that, did that come out in the book?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, here's the thing. In life, the music that influenced me early on was like James Taylor. Mm-hmm. But in the game of life, I didn't get dealt that card. And I'm actually kind of glad, because I've been able to make a living for the last 20 plus years playing music. You know, when the kids were growing up, I had a real job. Mm. And so, but now circumstances were such that I could do this. And it's been a wonderful experience to play music, especially in this context, and go home to the same wife every night, have dinner at home. So, I'm not touring the world, but music has been a wonderful experience.
But you do have, I mean, you have a website, you have CDs, you mm-hmm. have this book. You have a musical career, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I think a thing, if any musicians listening, if you figure out how to function in the sphere that you're in, you can make a career at this thing. Mm-hmm. And one of the hopes in the book is that musicians would hear this and go, hey, I could play songs for people and listen and talk and interact, because, you know, when I retired, I thought, okay, we need people to carry on. So I'm hoping that people will embrace this kind of use of music that isn't in the spotlight, but is very meaningful, front row on life.
Mm. Yeah, you wrote in the book that you hope to inspire other musicians to do some good, to use their gift to help others. Have you heard of anyone who took your spot at Riverside? Is there a guitarist wandering around?
Well, there's actually a lady who plays guitar, and she plays the singing bowls and a variety of things. So, yeah. But, you know, what was funny, when I was talking to my manager, explained that I would be leaving, he said, well, you're kind of a unicorn. And I go, well, no, I don't want to be. There's a lot of people that play guitar and play music and could do this. So they had a bit of a time. But, there's a lady named Katie who's filling in for what I used to do.
Okay, yeah. And, I mean, you did it for a long time. Did people around the hospital ever think, like, I can't believe you stayed this long doing this for more than 20 years playing music in the hospital?
I don't know what they could believe or not, but it was a joy, because I would get to be friends with the staff, mm-hmm. the nurses. I'll tell you, a shout out to the nurses. They are most, I think any nurse, anybody who dedicates himself to serve people and help them feel better is amazing. Cancer nurses are all that, and just amazing in how they treat people in these real difficult times. It's just a beautiful thing.
Well, you told us the story of the ballroom dancing couple. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us one more story from the book before we end?
Sure. One time I was invited into a room, and they said, oh, by the way, the woman's actively dying. Mm. And I go, oh. And so I go in, and the family is surrounding this lady and very weepy. And so we say, well, what would you like to hear? Well, hymns. So I play a couple hymns. Mm. And then the youngest son, her kids are standing around her massaging arm and feet. And the son is massaging her feet and says, well, you know, her favorite song was The Gambler.
Okay.
He said, can you play that? So here's this weepy room. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking down. I go, okay, focus. My lyrics are all on a tablet. And I'm going, no, and a hold, no, and a fold. And then about two-thirds of the way through the song, this lady pops up. She's been actively dying. She raises her hands in the air, kicks her feet, and says, that's my favorite song.
Oh, my gosh.
And the room went from, you know, sadness to like, oh, my gosh, mom, grandma, you're back. And then they had a great time visit. She went around the room. She said, I love you and you and you. Went all the way around the room and got to me and looked a minute and said, thanks for playing some music.
She's like, who is this guy?
I don't know who you are, but I'm glad you're here. And the thing is, we went along and she kind of went back to sleep or went back to rest. Mm-hmm. And then the guy said, well, you know, she's from Tennessee and her favorite song is Mountain Dew. Or they call it, not that one, Rocky Top, Rocky Top. So I play Rocky Top, pop, she pops up again.
Oh, my gosh.
And she goes around the room. It was such a beautiful thing, and really enjoyed seeing that. And that family, because of the gift of music, got at least a good 45 additional minutes to tell Mom, Grandma how much they loved her.
Oh, wow.
And she passed away later that evening, but they had such a wonderful memory of that time with her.
That's an amazing experience. And also now, anytime they hear those songs, they'll remember that moment. I mean, that's amazing, John. That's
well,
a great story.
You know, and I'm just the plastic bag that carries the medicine around inside. There's a little story about that in there.
Well, no, you're much more than that. You're the champion with the guitar. That was acoustic guitarist John Morgan. He was the artist in residence for Ohio Health from 2001 to 2022, where he played music for patients in the hospital, including cancer patients. And then he turned that experience into a book called Notes in the Key of C, Tuning Out Cancer, Tuning in Hope. Thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Amy. I appreciate being here.
And this is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Victor Omar D'Angelo's family immigrated to the United States from Argentina. Their food service journey transitioned from serving at the Latino Festival back in 2012 to a food truck in 2016, and finally a brick-and-mortar restaurant named Baraluco opening in 2018. The success of D'Angelo's Baraluco Argentine comfort food and Palma's Tropical Escape have resulted in him being named the 2025 Ohio Small Business Person of the Year. This came from the U.S. Small Business Administration. Victor, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah. So congratulations on being named the Ohio Small Business Person of the Year. That's awesome.
Yeah, this is amazing. I was surprised. But then I think there is a big and heavy story to tell. And it has been a lot of work to get here.
Yeah. How did you learn that you were going to get the honor? Did you even know you were nominated?
Yes. Someone nominated in the community. And then they told me, and there were many out there that have been nominated from different industries. And then one day they told me, like, connect to this link. And they told me, and I was crying, like, they told me, oh, you're going to get your award in Washington. So I'm like, oh, wow, is this really happening? And I'm representing Ohio as the person of the year, small business. So
that's amazing. Did you get to go to Washington?
Yes.
How was the event?
That was great. There were like all the representatives from different states. Mm-hmm. And so they have different like keynote speakers, and everything was very fancy there, and the networking was great there. So they chose the National Person of the Year, mm-hmm. which was a company from Michigan.
Oh, we lost to Michigan. Oh,
no.
So were there a lot of other restaurants there, or were you kind of in the minority of being a restaurant?
I saw other restaurants, mm-hmm. food truck, yeah, but then there were like realtors and different industries that a small business is considered 500 or less. So we were feeling very small compared to others.
Yeah, I mean, you must have. How many people work in your two restaurants?
So it has been very, because now the season for food truck, I take the food truck in festivals. Mm-hmm. So it can be from 20 to 30 people.
Okay, but that's less than 500, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what did it mean to you and your family to and your business, basically? What did it mean to you to get this award, to be the Ohio person for this year?
It means that it's really a recognition of all the work that we have done, not only for the everyday activities that we do, but also for the help that we have been providing to the community. Every year we have been donating to different organizations, LGBT communities, the Hispanic Chamber. Even during COVID, we donated like 200 paellas. Those are a dish to the OSU hospital, to the front of the line. My parents is still here in Columbus, and they're like, were amazed that we got this award.
Now, how old were you when your family came here from Argentina?
I was 18 years old.
Okay.
So I've been here for 24 years in Columbus.
And did they work in, did your family, do you come from a background, did you all work in the food service industry back in Argentina, or was that a new thing when you came to the U.S.?
My father had a bakery in Argentina, so I grew up in the business, helping him doing the pastries, go selling door by door, and eventually we moved here, and I had that knowledge, and then I said, let's go do our business. So in 2009 is when we started the home baking business, and then the Latino festival, the food truck, like I say, like you mentioned, the brick and mortar. Oh, no, I went to college too. Yeah.
In there you had time for that.
Yeah.
So how challenging was it to build your business? I mean, you started small and you grew in increments, but just building a business from scratch is a hard thing to do.
It is. It took many years, and I wanted to be very knowledgeable or understand how business work here. In my country, you just open a business, that's it. Here, there are different laws. So with the help of ECDI, also the SBA, and different companies, they help me to understand what I need, the regulations and employees too. So I did it little by little, so I get to know and train people that help me when I grow. So when I grew, I already had the team.
Yeah, and one of the challenges you faced is you opened Palma's cocktail bar. You had a soft opening in 2019 and you opened in early 2020. Talk about bad timing.
Oh, wow. Timing was a little difficult there because I signed the lease in January of the 19. And then in October, we did a soft opening just to try. But then we have different regulations that we couldn't open until 3 weekends before the shutdown of COVID. So we opened, it was very popular for 3 weekends, and then shut down.
Oh, that must have been so hard.
But then later they provided some regulations that we opened.
You were able to get some relief.
Yeah, until 10 because the curfew.
Yeah.
And then they lifted the curfew, and then we became one of the most popular Latino bars in Columbus. So it was a success after that. But then I think that our resilience, our consistency and hope help us to be in that position and then do good business.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Fascinating Ohio. We're talking to the 2025 Small Business Person of the Year from the U.S. Small Business Administration. It's Victor Omar D'Angelo. He's the owner of Barro Luco and Palma's Tropical Escape. So one of your goals with your restaurants is to educate customers about the food. What do you want people to know about cuisine from Argentina?
Our food is not spicy.
many people get asked that a lot? Yeah.
Yeah. They think it's spicy because we're Latinos. No, we compare a lot with European food. We have empanadas, the paella, steaks. And Yeah, we have some sauces that are spicy, as if they request it, we can do that. But most of the time, they think that it's spicy. It's very flavorful, like you don't have to add anything. So we have the empanadas that are filled with ground beef, different spices. You can do it in the oven or fried. And those are like turnovers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the paella is just the rice, the yellow rice with you can customize. In our place, you can customize to be gluten-free, vegan, vegetarian, or add any protein on it. Mm.
Do you have a favorite food that you make? Or what's your favorite thing to eat? Or maybe you have something different that's your favorite thing to make versus eat. Yeah.
I think I like to eat a little of everything. That's mm-hmm. why we created the sampler, mm-hmm. which brings the empanadas, a rib, and the paella, and plantains. Mm-hmm. So just a little bit of everything. And what do I like to make? The empanadas. Mm-hmm. The empanadas are very traditional in Argentina, in many other Latino countries also, but ours are just a little different. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I read that it's not just about the flavor for you. It's also about the culture. You want to teach people about the culture. Tell me about that.
Yeah. What we have is when we sit and eat, it's just like a ritual. We take our time to eat, and then it's a family time where we enjoy each other. So I think our food, and it's a whole experience to share with the family and spend the time. And I feel like here it's a little faster. Everything is too quick. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to tell people to enjoy themselves and don't use the cell phone so much.
Slow down and enjoy.
Yes. Yeah.
Not just the food, but the company too.
Correct.
Yes. Now, you run the business with family. What's that dynamic like? Can you separate the work-life balance there?
I think that all this year has been a little bit challenging since the beginning. But then we reach a point where we respect each other. Mm-hmm. And now my assistant is my sister. One of the manager is my brother. My father and my mother are retired, but they're like a bonus. Like they help us, and then we have employees. Mm-hmm. So before, when we were starting the business here in U.S., we started like a little like, I don't know, in shock or like yelling each other. But then eventually...
Little tension.
Yeah. We were able to overcome that and then just listen and understand that it's for the best interest. So after a while, we became like, it became a good dynamic working with the family because we all have the best interest for the business.
Hmm. Now, small business owners are risk takers. They're innovative. They certainly are hard workers. They've been called the backbone of the economy. Do you find it really hard to run a small business, but also rewarding?
It is hard, yes. I think it's harder at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And after you there for a little while, you set systems and employees, they get used to you, and it create, I feel like they're my family, mm-hmm. my employees. So I think it's important because we support them, support the economy, and I've seen many, many other small businesses that they put all their energy and heart in what they're doing because they love it. So I say yes, we help a lot the economy. We help a lot the employees and individuals to keep going in what they, you know, paying their bills, their responsibilities. So I think, yes, small businesses really are a good support for the local and national economy.
Can you get most of the ingredients you need to make the food the way you want to here? Or do you have to have it shipped from Argentina?
Some are being shipped from Argentina. Mm-hmm. And mostly, yes, we can do it. But then the dough for the empanadas, it comes from Argentina. My father used to do it, but he retired. Mm. So it's...
You need a particular set of skills for it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's different. And we can just go buy another one from another country, but it won't be the same. So we order from Argentina some of the products. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any plans for the future? Are you happy with just the two places and the food truck? Or are you going to expand?
We want to expand,
yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
I almost signed a contract in Cincinnati in October, but then didn't go. And I'm looking the suburbs here in Columbus to open a restaurant. Mm. So we're working.
So you're looking to expand not just in Columbus, but maybe somewhere else in Ohio too?
Correct.
Okay. Well, good luck. I hope that you succeed and I hope you find your new place. We have been speaking with restaurant owner Victor Omar D'Angelo of Baroluco, Argentine Comfort Food, and Palma's Tropical Escape. He's been named the 2025 Ohio Small Business Person of the Year by the U.S. Small Business Administration. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And this has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.